This is Vermont Law School's Environmental Hot Topics podcast. Vermont Law School's environmental programs have offered lectures from distinguished scholars, practitioners, activists, and public leaders for over a decade. Today, we bring the Vermont Law School Hot Topic Lecture Series to the web and to the world. My name is Rebecca Purdom, Assistant Dean for Environmental Programs at Vermont Law School. Bill Eubanks, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
So tell us, just to start off with, what is the Farm Bill?
So the Farm Bill is a piece of legislation that Congress reauthorizes every 5 years. And it was created as part of the New Deal back in 1933, where Franklin Roosevelt, went to Congress. And he worked out what at the time was a temporary safety net to protect small farmers in the face of the Great Depression. And at the same time, also find solutions to some of the other problems that were happening, including soil erosion and lack of nutrition for our children in schools. And so he set up a massive program that was supposed to be a one-time bill, in effect, to get through the Great Depression by putting certain types of controls in place to ensure that farmers would be able to make a livelihood during that period of time, and that some of the surplus goods coming out of that surplus crops would be used for nutrition assistance, both in the school lunches, but also for other people in need. And so the Farm Bill from that point, from 1933, it went from being was at the time a really transformative change in how we produce food and how we incentivize certain food and protect our farmers. But in 1938, Congress decided to reauthorize that. And so starting in 1938, ever since, we have every 5 years or so, Congress has reconsidered this issue and tried to figure out what should we do with the federal money that we're spending on agriculture, and what should we incentivize with that. And so over the course of the past 70 or 80 years, we've now had 15 reauthorizations of the Farm Bill. And so today, it actually funds a host of issues, everything from bioenergy to which types of commodity crops we produce here in the country, and which ones are receiving the predominant share of funding under direct payments, which is the most common form of subsidy that the public is used to. It deals with loan issues. It deals with crop insurance and other types of risk management approaches. And it also includes many conservation programs, both on-farm and off-farm conservation programs that farmers can undertake if they choose to do so, or in some cases there are mandatory conservation programs. So the Farm Bill has gone from a relatively small program to protect family farms, a temporary safety net, to today becoming a large, robust program that covers everything from energy to farming to conservation. So it has really taken the snowball effect and become something much larger than its original intent.
You said a couple of interesting things there that I think surprise folks who don't know about the Farm Bill. The first one is just the nature of the reauthorization, that we re-look at this every 5 years. That's not typical for our laws. When we typically pass some kinds of laws, we pass them once, and if you don't like them, you have to repeal them. But this is a law that comes up every 5 years. Why is that?
Well, so the way that Congress created the... Well, really, so this goes to the second Farm Bill. So as I mentioned, the Farm Bill was first authorized in 1933, when Congress came back and decided to reauthorize it a second time in 1938, they built in certain bedrock principles that, for the most part, have stayed in place through each reauthorization since. And because of that, we set up a system so that every 5 years or so, Congress would have to reauthorize most of the provisions, or they would revert back to 1938. And because of the way that Congress set up, they felt that conditions change. We know that depending on issues with droughts and floods and other things that on the ground, we're going to be seeing lots of changes over the course of time. And so it didn't make sense to do a one-time law. What they were really concerned about was the potential outdated nature of the Farm Bill over time. And so when they put the 1938, it was almost a threat to future Congresses that if you don't take the time to look at this issue on a site-specific basis in light of current conditions, you're going to have to revert back to a system that is at that time antiquated. And so up until now, the current political climate, we have seen every 5 years that this bill has been reauthorized. And, you know, while there are certainly some questions about what the objectives of the Farm Bill are now as they've changed, over the course of time, Congress has tried to address some of those new issues based on climate and other issues that arise in this context.
And when we think of most laws, the National Park Service Act, when Congress passed that, they created a park. But in the Farm Bill, we're not creating farms. This is really about how money is spent largely, isn't it?
It is. This is the Farm Bill is a large program in terms of the money that's allocated for it. And I should say that while the Farm Bill itself puts allocation numbers out for what Congress expects to appropriate, the actual money that's given under the Farm Bill is done through each annual appropriations program. And so, although there are guidance or standards that are put into place in the Farm Bill, we don't actually know until a given year how much money will be put out. But yeah, so these programs get into the billions annually. When we're talking about direct payments, for example, and some of the other subsidy programs, some of these run into a couple billion dollars each year. The bioenergy program is another large program I mentioned. The conservation programs collectively also. The Conservation Reserve Program and EQIP, the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, they are also, relatively large programs in terms of their budget. And so these are programs that collectively are essentially vehicles for getting money to different places where farmers are taking on different initiatives.
And you mentioned earlier that some of that money is going to farms and it's going to crop payments, which we'll talk about in a minute, or EQIP, where they're going to kind of infrastructure investments in farms. But you also mentioned some things that I think surprise people about the Farm Bill, that it's going into nutrition. I think every time the Farm Bill comes up, folks are a little startled to remember that what we think of as food stamps or now SNAP benefits are part of the Farm Bill, or that conservation is actually part of the Farm Bill. Why were those coupled into what is, I think most people perceive as to be money to farmers to help them farm better?
Right. Well, this is why a lot of people have argued that we should start calling the Farm Bill a food bill or a farming and food bill, because we do have this alliance of interest, both from the nutrition side as well as what most people would consider the farm side, sort of working together. And this is something that comes out of the early 1970s, where rural interests, who were focused on the farm portion of the Farm Bill, saw an opportunity to partner with the urban politicians, who their constituents, of course, in many cases in low-income communities, needed the supplemental nutrition assistance. And so that's where the marrying of these two different constituencies sort of formed. And ever since then, we've had this alliance between those two groups. And the passing of the Farm Bills has generally been quite, it's been uncontentious up until recent times. And I should say the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, which formerly food stamps, is actually right now is the number one funded piece of the Farm Bill. Right now it's about 60 to 70% of all of the Farm Bill money that's being appropriated is going towards supplemental nutrition assistance. So I do think that a lot of the public, you know, is probably thinking that most of these programs are focused on farming, where in reality a lot of the programs are actually focused on nutrition. But with that said, I think it's important to realize that we're still, direct payments, for example, we're still talking billions of dollars. The conservation programs collectively, we're talking in the billions. It just so happens that there are so many people who are eligible for supplemental nutrition assistance that the SNAP program itself is even a larger magnitude than the other payments we're talking about.
You mentioned that politically, the marrying of kind of rural interests and urban interests really help to marry the farm and the nutrition pieces. But there's been more politics than just that in the history of the Farm Bill. Certainly different rural parts of the country have very different interests, for example. Can you broadly characterize how the country has carved itself up around the Farm Bill?
Well, that's an interesting question. And it sort of depends on different times during that history over the past 80 years. But in general, without going into, sort of specific political battles that have happened, we do see constituencies from different geographic locations that are protecting their own folks. So, for example, a lot of different types of nuts are coming from Georgia. we have cotton.
You mean the food-based nuts?
Yes. Yes. We have good question. Not the political ones. Peanuts are coming from Georgia. We have cotton predominantly coming from places like Arkansas and other states even farther south than that. We have lots of our corn and our soybean coming from the Midwest, and our wheat and other commodities. Of course, we get lots of our vegetables and fruits and other almonds from California. So we have this interesting, because of the way that the U.S. is set up, and we have so much geography that has such different climates and soils, we really have a food system where certain things grow better in different places. And as a result of that, what we've seen over the course of many decades under the Farm Bill is the different politicians who represent these different constituencies, they've done a lot of horse trading to work out deals to make sure that the dairy industry has its protections, the almond industry has its protections, the peanut industry has its protections, obviously the large commodities, and I should say the five, what are called the big five commodities are corn, soybean, wheat, rice, and cotton. Over 90% of direct payments go to those five, with corn being the number one. And so all those different constituencies are generally protected under the under the Farm Bill, with the exception of fruits and vegetables, which do tend to have the least protection, for lack of a better phrase, under Farm Bill policies. That is the one that tends to sort of operate on its own. And I will mention just briefly that the Farm Bill does take sort of a peculiar view. They use the term specialty crop for the things that would appear to be the staples of our of a nutritious food system: fruits, vegetables, nuts, wild rice, the things that are sort of the whole grains and the greens and our fruits. Those are actually treated as specialty crops, and they are not eligible for many of our subsidies under the Farm Bill.
Is that going to change? And we'll talk about this more, but is there a movement to change some of that, the treatment of the specialty crops?
Well, there have been advocacy organizations for years who have pressed in that direction. I do think that there is a raised consciousness about that. But where we are right now with some of the partisan battles over what to do with the Farm Bill and whether direct payments, for example, and some of the other programs should continue to exist at this point and into the future, it's not entirely clear where the fruits and vegetables stand. The other piece of this that's really important is I personally have spoken with farmers who tend to farm on a smaller scale, sustainable agriculture. And in many of those cases, the farmers actually say that they would rather not have federal regulation. They think that once you bring in the federal government and you allow subsidies for that, it's actually going to bring more competition for them and potentially drive their prices down. So, this is one of those issues where you can talk to different people even within the same industry, even at the same level, small-scale farms, and they might have a different view about whether these should or should not be subsidized.
Well, let's talk a little bit about those subsidies. You've done some writing on some of the issues that are currently hot under the reauthorization of the Farm Bill, and one of those is this whole idea of crop insurance, which I think is where most folks think. There's a couple of different programs that people think of when they think of the Farm Bill, and crop insurance, I think, for all of us who know anything about the 30s or, frankly, are looking at what's happening in some weather events in the United States right now, are somewhat familiar with. And there's a variety of different programs that we kind of lump under crop insurance. But before we go there, can you just describe why we have crop insurance? What was the purpose of that sort of idea?
Sure. Well, crop insurance is a risk management system set up to ensure that farmers are able to have a contingency system set in place. And really what it is there are various ways that the federal government might subsidize the premium on the front end that a farmer would pay, the insurance premium, just very much like a premium you or I would pay for health insurance. Or on the back end, when a claim is paid out, the federal government through federal subsidies, in the event of a loss, a covered loss, just like any other insurance program, the government might pay an additional amount on top of what the insurance company would pay. And so by having these government-backed insurance programs, there are various mechanisms, again, whether it's on the front end or on the back end, in which we ensure that farmers are protected in the event of a drought, a flood, or other, if there's a pest infestation that meets the eligibility requirements. But again, I will say that some of those requirements are fairly strict, so it depends on the policy. It depends on the crop. These are different from, if you're growing cotton in the South, it's much different than the policy you might get for growing corn in the Midwest. And so it really depends on the geography as well as the insurance companies. And they've, of course, calculated all of the different possibilities in their scenarios.
Right down to minute details of weather events. The ultimate goal, of course, was to keep one event from wiping one particular farmer or at least one industry off the map.
Correct. The worst case scenario, of course, is a flood or a drought that wipes out the entire corn crop or the entire soy crop. And so that was sort of the initial programs that were put into place. I've looked at some of the insurance contracts from back in the 1930s, and they were much more elementary than what we have today. Today, like any other insurance policy you might have on a car or a home, these things can go on for hundreds of pages. They include many riders and addendums. So you wonder when a farmer signs onto these how much they even understand, because as we know, a lot of people don't read these, incredibly long documents. But the fact is we're moving towards a more risk management based approach. It appears that in the current farm bill, and I hope it's okay to jump into this.
Yeah,
a bit,
please go.
That in the current farm bill, we both the House and the Senate seem to agree that direct payments, which was essentially paying farmers who were growing eligible commodities on acres that had historically grown those commodities, Congress was appropriating money to be funded, given to them in a check that was cut at the end of each fiscal year based on those acres. That program right now, it appears that the House and Senate are willing to move away from that approach of direct payments into a much more what they call risk management based approach. And so by doing that, they're going to be making it both so that on the front end, as I was mentioning with the premiums, the government will be backing some of that. And so that will be a significant income boon to the farmer who now has to pay less for his insurance policy. But also, too, on the back end, in the event of a claim, the federal government would be helping with that. And that's a gross oversimplification because it's very different from crop to crop. But in essence, what we're doing is we're taking the same pot of money that was before it was just a check through a direct payment, and now we're doing it through crop insurance, either at the beginning when you get your insurance policy or in the event of a covered loss when you're getting your claim. So we're the same farms will still be essentially getting the money for it, but we're shifting the mechanism and how that is achieved.
And you've written that that's a good idea.
I do think it's a positive step in the right direction. I do think that direct payments had a host of problems, and that's something that's been well discussed on throughout the mainstream literature. And I think that for various reasons, including absentee landowners, for example, who were not actually farming on those acres so long as there was a historical connection to commodity production on those acres, they received the same check as people, as farmers who were actually out, creating a food supply. So I think we're addressing those types of issues that were raised during the direct payment regime that's been in place for several decades. One of the downsides of moving to the risk management system is currently we don't have a risk management system that accurately provides the same type of safety net for smaller scale and organic farmers. Farmers that are certified, USDA certified organic, or even farmers who are not don't have the certified label, but they still do things in a biodynamic or sustainable fashion, they have very unique risks that you just don't have in the conventional model, which is what we tend to encourage through our insurance policies through the Farm Bill. And so one of the big changes I would like to see, I think we've made a step in the right direction by going to risk management, but I think we need to set up our policies so that they equitably are distributed so that farmers, regardless of the size of their operation and the types of practices they're using, their insurance policies meet their specific needs.
You've also suggested that a cap makes sense for folks who, I'm wondering about the farms that might just be in a bad location and they get hit 3, 4, 5 times with a flood. And maybe we shouldn't be paying the insurance out and reestablishing that farm. Mm-hmm. Are you suggesting that we shift some of the money from those farms that we seem to keep putting money into, whether it's through direct payments or through these subsidies, either on the front end, the premium or the back end and the payouts, and actually make some of that money available to some of these smaller and more diverse farms?
I think that that would be a worthy goal. I think it would be difficult under, with our political constituencies in Congress right now. But I do think, I've written about how direct payments, which is still technically the status quo until we have a new farm bill moving towards the risk management system, that we absolutely need to put some caps on, you know, how much a particular farm can get for direct payments, or change the eligibility requirements possibly. And I think the same thing is true for risk management. I think we need to make sure that in these insurance policies that, again, it comes back to this idea of sort of all of the, take the farm industry as a whole. We have 2.1 million farms in the U.S. and figure out, how do we equitably share this? Do we look at money sort of based on acreage, sort of what percentage a particular farm makes up of the farms that are in the U.S. in production? Are we looking at it on a farm-by-farm basis? Each farm deserves some sort of, some risk management-based protection, and we need to figure out exactly how to do that. One of the things I wanted to mention with that is, I had said how, organic and small-scale farms are sort of at a disadvantage right now, and there was an amendment that was proposed as part of the current Farm Bill process to address some of those issues, the crop insurance inequities that currently exist, from organic to conventional insurance policies. And it was included, it was adopted into the Senate Farm Bill, but it was not into the House Farm Bill. So until we actually have a chance to go to conference and see what comes out of that process, it's not entirely clear whether there will be effective organic insurance policies that make sense with federal subsidies. And so they might be left on their own, as they have been before, which, as I mentioned earlier, some small-scale farmers are fine with that approach. But it certainly does put them at an economic disadvantage with their competitors.
I should mention that we're recording this in the summer of 2013. So this conversation is going on right while we're having our talk. One of the arguments that's sometimes made is maybe the small farmers don't necessarily want the subsidies, but maybe they don't deserve it, because these small farms, cute, trendy, adorable, you drive by the farm stand, you think it's lovely, but they're not actually producing the level of, or the amount of food stuff that is actually feeding us. And so to divert money away from larger farms into, even if it's not being equitable, it's probably not being efficient to divert that kind of stability to these smaller, more, hobby farms, or these much smaller organizations. What's your response to that critique?
Well, I think you can play devil's advocate with that a bit, and look at, well, and this goes back to a key question of what's the objective of the Farm Bill? And the original objective, as I mentioned, was to protect family farms and provide a nutritious food product for the public. Where we're at today, I think that there are some strong arguments that would suggest that that's not what we're doing. Today, as a result of some of our policies in the 1970s and 1980s, our Farm Bill really is reflective of maximizing yields at all costs, regardless of what some of the environmental impacts of that might be. And we've essentially set up a system where, as I mentioned, 90% of our subsidies under the Farm Bill are going to the Big Five, predominantly corn and soybean. And so what we're seeing is that so many of our products on the supermarket shelf are made with processed corn and processed soy, high fructose corn syrup we see in so many products, and that's just one of many that we see. Whereas at the same time, some of these smaller farms, while they might be small in terms of acreage, and small even in terms of the market that they're selling to, they might be producing 50 or 60 or 70 products all on one small plot of land. And so in terms of actually producing food, providing the things that people can eat and then meet their recommended daily allowances, as FDA has set, I think the small-scale farms are actually much more efficient in getting food and fiber to the American public. So yes, there's no question in terms of scale. The industrialized farm that only grows a single commodity, they're going to grow much more food. And they might even, maximize the yield, the percentage yield better for that one crop. But in terms of what you're actually taking to market and what people can make with that, I think that the smaller scale farm is more efficient in my view.
We've been talking about crop insurance and what we do with our money if a crop gets wiped off the face of the landscape through a flood or a tornado or whatever. But I want to talk about another part of the Farm Bill, which is the money that might be paid to a farmer when they're planting. That's another way that the Farm Bill actually helps farmers out. Can you talk about the planting flexibility programs?
Yes. So one of the really transformative ideas that was sort of brought to bear back in the late 1980s and was formalized into the 1990 Farm Bill was called planting flexibility. And what planting flexibility did is it procured a substantial victory at the time, a means by which farmers who grow commodity crops, who are getting direct payments and other types of what kind of fall under the main commodity subsidies under Title I of the Farm Bill, it gave them the flexibility to incorporate a certain percentage of their base acres, which they're otherwise getting these subsidies for, and to grow vegetables and fruits and wild rice. Those are the three sort of categories of things that were available under the planning flexibility rules. And, you know, a lot of the sustainable agriculture advocates saw this as a huge step, a positive step forward, because now in many places where commodities are grown in monocultures as really the only crop, including in the Midwest, for example, you drive by, you know, field after field of corn, now they could actually grow lettuces and spinaches and carrots and things that they could feed their families with, feed the local communities with. It really was a rural development type of objective. And, you know, it seemed like it was going to have achieve some really important results. Unfortunately, and this happens often in the political world, there were lobbies who saw that this was something that could hurt their own bottom line. And the lobby in this case was the fruit and vegetable lobby, which they have strong, you know, if you look in California, for example, many of our fruits and vegetables, especially our salad greens, come from that region. And so the trade groups that represent this lobby realized quickly that this was going to be potentially take away a large market share that they had since the existence of the Farm Bill. And so they put together their power and said, wait a minute, these planning flexibility rules could be very harmful. And they worked very hard. And so through some different attempts, which I think it was first through an appropriations bill, and then it was put into the 1996 Farm Bill the next time it was reauthorized, the planning flexibility rules were essentially nullified. And so by doing that, there was essentially a hollow victory, which, you know, existed for a period of time on paper, but never was really able to yield the results of, you know, having more food available for local communities and farm-to-school programs. And still today, 23 years since the original planning flexibility rules were put into place, we still have farmers saying, please give us, you know, just a piece of our land. You know, these might be 2,000-acre farms, and they're just asking for 20 acres or 40 acres to be planting a much more diverse mix of crops.
If I understand this, it seems somewhat ironic that an attempt to actually create more fruits and vegetables available to the kind of the buying public was actually defeated by the fruit and vegetable producers, who hadn't at that point been getting money or as much money under the Farm Bill as the large commodity producers. I mean, it seems like strange bedfellows there.
It is, you know, and the thinking on it, which is you know, when you connect it up, it somewhat makes sense, because the fruit and vegetable lobby generally does not get much in the way of subsidies. Some of them do certain types of conservation programs, but in general, even the larger vegetable farms in California, for example, they're not receiving the Title I subsidies, the commodity subsidies. And as a result, what they feared was that farms that were receiving those Title I commodity subsidies for growing corn or wheat or some other eligible commodity, so already being supported by the federal government, then would be able to grow the vegetables on their lands and sell them and be able to compete at a lower price because they're backed by the government through those subsidies. And so it sort of set up a system where the fruit and vegetable lobby felt that it was an unfair advantage that they had because they were getting their direct payment checks, sometimes in the neighborhood of a couple $100,000 or even up to $1 million a year. I mean, these can be quite sizable. And so you can understand, you know, at that level, how it might make, you know, some sense. But at the same time, it goes back to this question, which I'll return to again, is what is the objective of our Farm Bill? What is the point of the policies we put in place?
Well, and you said earlier that, you know, 60 to 70, at least two-thirds of the Farm Bill has actually been nutrition-focused, at least in the more recent past. And yet the program that would provide arguably more nutritious food, or at least pull some food out of the commodities market and make it available in things that we tend to think are more nutritious, like fruits and vegetables, was actually seen, lowering the price point on that was actually fairly threatening to the people who currently produce the majority of our fruits and vegetables.
Correct.
Is the fruit and vegetable industry that vulnerable? If we start making really cheap lettuce, are we going to have no lettuce because the price, you know, we've needed them to be relatively isolated so they could keep their price point high?
I've looked into to some of the journals that focus on the agricultural economics of this particular issue, and, you know, there's sort of data going both ways, and, you know, like any of these issues, people, the rhetoric quickly gets somewhat emotional. I can say that there are studies pointing towards, you know, there are some studies that have said that it would actually be, maybe the best system would be to leave the planning flexibility rules in place, allow farmers to have that flexibility, but if they're going to do that, actually shift a small portion of what is currently going to commodities under the Title I programs to some of the fruit and vegetable industry, and that might be a way. Again, we start running into these questions, though, of, well, how do the smaller, you know, fruit and vegetable farmers fit into that equation? So there are different ways to get at that, but I do think that this is definitely an issue where, you know, they certainly saw a disadvantage in terms of the competition that they would be, you know, that they would have to address. And, you know, I think that there are studies that go both ways. This is one of those issues where it's not entirely clear what the market signals would do. And this is, I'll use this opportunity to say that that's one of the downsides of the Farm Bill in general. I mean, the Farm Bill is an incredibly complex, ambitious piece of legislation. Over the course of 80 years, it's had many different goals and objectives it was trying to achieve. And that's part of, you know, this problem we find ourselves in, is those goals have changed very drastically. But at the same time, we have this this system now. We've created sort of this dual system where, you know, we have sort of local and regional food systems at a smaller level, but even fruits and vegetables tend to be grown almost in their own separate framework. It's almost as if we have two separate frameworks, the commodity crops growing just this handful, very small handful of crops, much of it used for energy, much of it used for livestock feed, things that aren't even human consumption. And then on the other hand, we have, you know, this very small market of people growing the things that, again, as you said, are generally regarded as the nutritious things that we actually need on a daily basis. And so I think one of the things that we'll need to do at some point, whether it's in the 2013 Farm Bill or in the future, is really figure out where we're at now, what our current objectives are, and figure out how to balance these things out. Because one of the most striking things is we do have enough cropland in production to feed everyone right now. And one of the most interesting arguments I've always heard, and the evidence supports this, is hunger and malnutrition is not a food problem. It's not a food supply issue. It truly is a political and a social issue. So it's all about how we allocate our dollars, what we're incentivizing. And we have to remember that we haven't actually had a free agricultural market, a free market since 1933. And arguably, we didn't even have one before that because there were still price supports in place before that. So, you know, there are a lot of different ideas about what would happen if we completely took farm policies away and let the free market operate. But to the extent that we're going to continue to have some sort of subsidization, we do need to figure out, you know, what the correct allocation is and where the fruit and vegetable lobby would fit in that.
And you have actually said that you think allowing for the planting flexibility program, to the one that was passed in the 90s that may have been nullified, to let that come back into play, you actually think that's a good idea.
I do, to the extent that we're going to be continuing, you know, this is premised on the assumption that we're continuing with Title I commodities. We're going to have direct payments and other types of subsidies that act either as, so the basic premise of most of our subsidies is we're either paying you to grow as many crops of a particular crop as you can, or we're paying you not to grow something so that we can supply, we can control the supply. And so, through, if we're going to continue with that program, and it appears that that's going to be the status quo, although we're going to be, we're seeing the House and the Senate, as I mentioned, thinking about getting rid of direct payments in lieu of risk management approach, but all of these other subsidy programs will still persist. And so if that's the floor we're working from, I think that planting flexibility offers a real opportunity. I actually saw a study recently from a nonprofit organization that is one of the leading voices on these issues. And they did a study talking to, it was close to 30,000 farmers, looking at whether they were actually taking part in conservation programs, whether they were actually growing fruits, vegetables, and to the ones that were commodity farmers, asking them, if you had the opportunity, would you? And, you know, who knows how this would actually come out in practice, but 44% of the people who responded, the farmers who responded, who were commodity farmers and were not allowed to grow on their base acres, but fruits and vegetables, said that they would if given the opportunity. So there appears to be a real interest there, a real opportunity. I think what we have to figure out is how can we do it in a way where we're not undercutting the other people within that same fruit and vegetable industry.
You just a minute ago mentioned conservation programs. I think one of the things folks find interesting is, on the one hand, the Farm Bill is paying farmers to, you know, plow up dirt and put seeds in it and grow stuff. And yet that within the Farm Bill, there's also another piece of programming that asks farmers to protect environmental resources and to not plant things and to preserve not only you know, trees and grass, but wildlife. And it actually has a fairly significant play in the way that we look at the conservation of our natural resources. in this country. Can you describe for folks a little bit both what the conservation programs kind of do, and maybe talk a little bit about the irony or the tension there that on one hand we're telling farmers plant stuff, and then with a different check we say, and by the way, don't plant it over here, and save the bunnies.
Yeah, so we have close to 30 conservation programs in the Farm Bill currently. In the 2013 Farm Bill process, Congress has been looking at consolidating a few of them. But in general, without going into specifics of each program, some of these are working lands programs, things that are happening on farms that are currently in production, and then others are farms that, where the land is being taken out of production, like the Conservation Reserve Program. And then there are also a few that actually address off-site mitigation. So while a farm is continuing to operate and produce food on its farm, it's doing something for off-site habitat elsewhere. And so we have this sort of complex mix of different programs that are available. And so it gives farmers lots of options, especially the ones who are conservation-minded and want to take the initiative and be proactive, whether it's truly motivated by getting that extra check in the mail or for the conservation efforts, it at least provides different options. And there is a bit of a tension, and I do know that,
I want to stop you there for a second, because you said something important. I don't want to let go. These are incentive programs. Environmental regulation programs happen somewhere else, often in state agencies of ag. So these are only programs for folks who are conservation-minded, who choose to participate. These are not necessarily regulatory programs that tell farmers what they can't do. Is that correct?
Correct. The only mandatory conservation programs under the Farm Bill are called conservation compliance programs, and that is commonly referred to as sod buster and swamp buster. And those are fairly minimal requirements where a farmer who is getting any commodity subsidies under Title I, most conservation subsidies under Title II, and then certain other types of subsidies under the Farm Bill, they are not allowed to convert a wetland to agricultural production unless they jump through a lot of hoops. And they're not able to grow crops on what are called highly erodible lands, marginal farmlands. And so in any event, those are fairly basic requirements. They have been shown to have some really key conservation benefits. But other than those two mandatory programs, the rest of these are options. They're things that farmers can enroll in. They often have to submit an application or a grant. There is not always funding for every farm that is interested in participating in these programs. So it is... it's sort of your classic program where you have to A, be eligible, and then B, you have to put in some effort and paperwork to ask for that type of funding.
Is there some tension between asking farmers to plant on one hand and on the other hand waving a check at them and saying, if you take 10 or 20 acres out of production for conservation purposes, we could give you money over here. Is that a challenge to balance within the Farm Bill?
It is. I think it's... I will say from the farmer's perspective, so the same study I had mentioned earlier with respect to planting flexibility, we know that farmers in general, this is obviously a generality, but we know that farmers are very interested in conservation. It is a livelihood that is highly dependent on productive soils and ensuring that there is clean water and all sorts of resources that are available. They recognize that pollinators are key to what they do. And so farmers care about conservation. And so I think at least from the farmer perspective, having the conservation options available, it's something that they really appreciate having the ability if they choose to, take a couple of years off so that the fields can have a chance to fix nitrogen, to allow cover cropping or something. It's something that they really like from the standpoint of their economic incentive. In terms of the Farm Bill itself, the policy side, There is somewhat of a tension to be saying grow as much as you can, and at the same time, next year we don't want you to grow at all if you choose to opt into that program. But at the same time, I think that they are sort of a natural outgrowth of the same. It sort of goes back to that original Farm Bill where we were dealing not only with the Great Depression, and many farmers were losing their farms, foreclosures were happening, but also, too, we were dealing with the Dust Bowl and some of those issues. And so... the Farm Bill, since its beginning, there have been a lot of fits and starts with the Farm Bill, but we have seen that, there have always been at least some conservation programs on the table, and most of them invariably have been focused on taking the most marginal lands out of production. So it's never really been intended as a measure to, affect the farming industry as a whole. It's really been focused on what are our most sensitive habitats, what are the locations that cause the most impacts to water quality because of erosion and sedimentation, and how can we sort of address those marginal lands while at the same time giving our farmers an incentive not to grow on those lands. So, you know, while theoretically, philosophically, you know, you could see a tension there, it's something that's existed since the beginning of the Farm Bill. And to me, it's just another option available to farmers. So it's, you know, if you choose to grow corn, you get this type of money. If you choose to do, you know, fruits and vegetables, if you're in an area that would allow you to do that, the soils and the climate, you might get a premium on your product because you're selling those types of products, which tend to, the farmer takes home many more cents on the dollar than you do if you're growing corn. And then, you know, if you decide to put the lands into a conservation program, that's just another pot of money that's available.
We mentioned earlier with the crop, particularly with the crop insurance program, that it tended to favor the larger farmers, or at least the farmers with larger land bases. Is that similar here with the conservation programs? Are the smaller farmers out of luck a little bit when they try to pursue conservation goals, or at least try to pursue incentives around conservation goals?
In some cases, it really depends on the conservation program you're talking about. The one that I've spent the most time looking at is the Conservation Stewardship Program, CSP. And in my view, this is a program that I do stand behind. I think it's a really solid program. It has actually recently become the largest program in terms of funding of the various conservation programs that exist, but it still needs additional funding. And just to back up a little bit, the Conservation Stewardship Program is a program that uses an environmental benefits score, and that has been put together over many years using lots of stakeholders from the farming industry and scientists to come up with concrete things a farm could do to increase the environmental benefits that their farm is providing to the public. And so that can be anything from making your farm more energy efficient, putting in drip irrigation technology to make it so that you're more water efficient, even small-scale renewable energy potentially. There are so many different things that can be done. And through the CSP program, it's set up a system where we can measure or attempt to measure what environmental benefits a farm, big or small, is having on the environmental externalities that it would otherwise be producing. And what we've seen, though, with that program as well as some others is CSP is farm neutral, meaning that anyone can apply for this. So small farms can apply, large farms can apply. But this is another program where right now there's not 100 are far more farms applying than they have the dollars available. So we really need Congress to put some more funding in that program. But additionally, right now, the way that the average per acre payment is set up, it does discourage small farmers from wanting to apply for the program because you can only get a certain number of dollars per acre. So if you're a 10-acre farm, it's probably not going to be worth the paperwork. I believe right now it's somewhere in the neighborhood of about $18 per acre is the average that they're giving. So a 10-acre farm, the most they might get is $180. There is a big question. Now, the grants can be up to $40,000 per farm over the course of time. But the problem with that, of course, is if you're small, you're never going to see, you know, anywhere near that amount. You're talking about, you know, $18 to maybe $30 an acre. And so anyway, one of the calls for change that I've talked about and a lot of other people have talked about is finding a way to take what right now is sort of size neutral and set up a system so that under CSP or some of these other programs, farms under 50 acres or under 25 acres, they're able to get a higher per acre payout or payment coming from CSP and related programs. So in any event, one thing, I think it's a really positive step that we're now opening many of our programs to the smaller farms. But if we want to actually have smaller farms participating, I think we have to encourage them to do it because, you know, if we're talking $200, it's very difficult for a small farm, especially because they already, you know, you're usually talking one or two laborers, maybe a couple more. But, you know, to take the time out to fill out essentially a grant application, it's very taxing on them when the return on investment's, you know, $500 or less.
We've been talking a lot about programs around farms and growing on land, and I want to turn our attention to at least two parts of the Farm Bill that are really apparent to those of us who are consumers. And the first one I think a lot of folks are familiar with is the USDA organic labeling. I can go into most of my grocery stores and find at least some series of products that have a USDA organic label on it, and that's still relatively new. For many years, the USDA and the Farm Bill really didn't have anything to do with organic labeling. Maybe you can talk just a little bit about the history of organic labeling, and then we can talk about how the Farm Bill plays into that. But when did the federal government get in this game, and who was doing it before?
Yeah, so the National Organic Program is relatively new, as you said. It was, I think, first written in 1990 is when the act came out, and the first rules really implementing it didn't come out until 1997. So we're in our relative infancy. We're, you know, in the first two decades still of actual implementation of the National Organic Program. Prior to that, I mean, there were third-party certifiers, and a lot of people were sort of doing it on their own individual scale. But once USDA got involved, once Congress authorized USDA to get involved, they set up a body called the National Organic Standards Board, which really went through and figured out here are the things we'll allow to be part of the National Organic Program, and here are the things that don't fit under the program. And what I mean by that is the label, you know, means certain things in that there are certain products that are prohibited for use in an organic product and certain things that are allowed for use. It doesn't mean that each product does actually use each one of them, but it does mean that on the prohibited list, they haven't used any of those, unless very certain exemptions arise and they're able to get an exemption for that. So one thing, though, I'd like to remind people about the organic program is the organic label has been, I think most advocates who work on these issues would say it's been wildly successful in the sense that it provides key information to the public that did not exist, you know, before it was just nutritional labels. Now we have a label that does mean something. And so for the informed public who know what it means, you know what is allowed and what is prohibited, it's very key in terms of disclosing that information. One of the downsides, and this is something I talk about in some of the writing that I've done, is that the organic label itself is no more than a construction of a regulatory process. And the reason I bring that up is it means that the definition of organic can change from year to year and administration to administration. And so, you know, while right now I would say, you know, in its first 15, 16 years, it's been incredibly successful, it's really important that the groups who work on these issues remain vigilant in sort of safeguarding that label, making sure that they're providing comments. You know, the National Organic Standards Board meets four times a year, and those are open to the public. And so I always encourage people interested in this issue to go sit in on those meetings and submit comments so that people can be involved in that process.
And the Farm Bill in particular, it doesn't, the organic labels are set by an agency process, but the Farm Bill actually puts money into the organic program. How does it do that?
So the the Farm Bill, starting I believe with the 2002 Farm Bill, started allocating funding for mostly for organic research, which under the Farm Bill, that is often how when there's something new that you know we don't exactly know how the market is going to respond to it, Congress initially puts money into research, and so they did that in 2002. They actually strengthened the amount of funding in 2008. And there are calls for them to, you know, double or triple what they had done in 08 in this current Farm Bill process. So there's certainly funding going into the organic research piece of it, including looking at are there differences between organically produced foods and conventional produced foods of the same type. That's one of the interesting questions that's out there. Another one, of course, is this issue of organic insurance that we've talked about is, well, what would an equitable insurance policy look like for an organic producer, an organic apple producer, for example? So those are the types of issues that the Farm Bill has allocated to USDA, and USDA's, they have a wing called the Economic Research Service, and so they're undertaking a lot of that in conjunction with research universities. The other piece of it, which has happened as a result of both the 02 and the 08 Farm Bill, is there is a program called the Organic Certification Cost Share Program, which this is intended to actually benefit the smaller producers. And so if a producer meets certain eligibility requirements, the government will subsidize a piece of their organic certification paperwork. You have to fill out the paperwork and send a check in, which depending on the given year can be between $600 and $1,000. And depending on the funding available, the federal government through USDA will subsidize 50 to 70% of that, depending on your size, if you meet the eligibility.
Wow. The final program I just want to touch on briefly, and I know we're almost out of time, but the Farm Bill has been talking about large farms and big farms and, you know, big areas. We've talked about some of the problems with small areas, but there's kind of a new focus, just like organic kind of got hot and it's something as a consumer I look for. I'm now also going to my local farmer's market, and I'm going to my local, you know, food purveyors. The Farm Bill hasn't traditionally worked with small food producers and kind of small food systems. And yet, at least in the current Farm Bill, we're starting to hear more of a conversation about that, probably because it is trendy within the public. What is the Farm Bill, how is the Farm Bill approaching kind of these new small producers?
Yeah, so we're starting to see smaller, just like with organics, these things happen gradually. And so with local and regional food systems, we're starting to see some programs getting put into the Farm Bill, as well as advocacy groups pushing for others that we hope will be there one day, because I think they will not only strengthen local food systems, but they will also strengthen rural vitality and rural development and infrastructure. And so a couple examples of programs I've seen that have been, in my opinion, wildly successful. So we have the Farmers Market Promotion Program, which is a relatively new program put into one of the most recent farm bills. And under that, Congress has appropriated funding to help farmers markets, in some cases, initiate to get started, and in other places where they're already established, to help them build the infrastructure between the farmers markets and the farmers on the ground. And one of the key things I've seen, which is really important if we're going to address nutrition, is they have funded getting the EBT cards, the electronic benefit transfer capabilities for SNAP recipients at the farmers markets. And so within a couple of years, through the Farmers Market Promotion Program and some other programs that exist, we should have 100% capability at all farmers markets for SNAP recipients to be able to purchase the goods that they purchase at farmers markets, and make it so that some of these issues of food deserts and other terms that are used in low-income communities, they'll have these other options available. Another program, this is not in the Farm Bill yet, but there has been a lot of talk about it, is getting a double up bucks program, so that when those SNAP recipients go to farmers markets or roadside stands, they will get an additional premium from the federal government, so that if they were to spend $10 on local produce as opposed to going to the corner store and buying junk food, they would actually have $20 available to them, but only if they use it on at those types of facilities. So Farmers Market Promotion Program is doing a lot of really great things. Another really key program is the Value-Added Producer Grant Program. And what that does is it provides grants to not only farmers, but also people who process and come up with a new food. So if you take peppers and you process them into hot pepper jelly or things like that, there are these grants available to help you ramp up your business so that you go from being, possibly just in your own little community to making it so you're more at a regional level and you're able to get out possibly in the schools, doing farm to institution stuff, maybe working with local prisons or local hospitals. And so they've provided funding. And this is, unfortunately, one of those programs, like others we've talked about, where there are more people who want to participate than there are grants available. But again, the fact that we have that now and Congress is committed to that, I think it's something that we could put money into and strengthen that program. Because again, many of these grants are going into places where they need to strengthen the rural development. A lot of these are in, one in particular that I've seen was in Iowa. And it was a farmer who was making a particular processed product and was able to ramp it up from, he had sold for 20 years in his town. But he was able to take it up to the next level, and now he's selling in a three-state area. Just based on that, he got, a $20,000 grant to help him do the research to figure out, is there a market there? So it can be sort of a research grant or an infrastructure grant. And then finally, one of the things that we talk about a lot in the community are how do we use food hubs, which is a term, sort of a term of art in the food community, which are really places to aggregate produce coming in, not just produce, but any food items coming in from farmers, from processors, and then getting it back out to whether it's retailers or farm to institution type programs. And this has come up most prominently in the school lunch program, the National School Lunch Program, which is our second largest nutrition program after SNAP. We feed 31 million children every single day, 9 months of the year. And so one of the questions is, how can we build a better infrastructure through the Farm Bill or otherwise to have these aggregation centers and then distribute it out to schools and other facilities that are in need of this? So again, I mentioned hospitals, prisons. And so we're just on the edge of starting to get some of those things funded in the Farm Bill and also another statute called the Child Nutrition Reauthorization. And between those two, I'm seeing sort of this move, a commitment for the first time towards local and regional foods. So I should say this doesn't mean that we should absolutely move away from the model that has persisted, the status quo, but it at least allows, just like we allow farmers to have options under the Farm Bill, it allows consumers to have options too.
It sounds like this conversation about local foods and local farms and local consumers is somewhat a counterpoint with the where we started the conversation around crop insurance for those five big commodity farms. Is this a real tension, or, you know, are we really pulling away from kind of the center of the Farm Bill, or is this just looping back to that original purpose for preserving family farms after the Depression?
I think so. This gets into, you know, when I teach about these issues or write about these issues, you know, the hardest thing to pin down is what is the objective of the Farm Bill, and I've come back to that a couple of times. And the thing is during our 80 years of the Farm Bill, the objectives have changed so quickly. And so we've tried to meet all of these different goals, but we never actually stay for the long term. It's, you know, 10 years later, something has changed. And so I think, you know, one of the things is where we're at now, we have a movement. You know, there are lots of consumers who are interested in knowing where their food comes from. We now have USDA acknowledging that for the first time in my knowledge. They have a program called Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food, which was instituted by their Deputy Secretary, Kathleen Merrigan. And it's really a way to bridge consumers with farms and other retailers who are attempting to keep both money and food within the community to some extent. So, I think this is very much like the original Farm Bill. It's a response to what consumers need and what they're asking for. Of course, we have, 300 million people, very diverse set of interest and different types of food systems people might want. But I do think that the Farm Bill, to the extent that we're going to keep this system in place, as opposed to, just a free market without legislation, we have to make sure we're catering to all the different constituencies and providing options to all the different consumer groups. Because I think what the backlash that led to the potential elimination of direct payments, which is what's being considered in Congress now, I think was the fact that it was seen by the public as really siphoning off most of our farm money towards one constituency. And so I think the pendulum is starting to swing back where people are saying, we're okay with other constituencies having theirs, but we want to make sure that we have options available too. So I think that's, over the next 10 years or so, the next couple of farm bills, I think one of these key questions is going to be, how do we balance those different priorities? How does a local and regional food system and farm-to-institution work? How does that fit into the more industrial commodity system? And that's something that, I think Congress is going to have a really tough time reconciling those two.
Bill Eubanks, thanks for joining us today at Vermont Law School.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Vermont Law School Environmental Hot Topics podcast. We hope you can join us for future podcasts on this channel. For more information about Vermont Law School's environmental programs, including links to talks by experts interviewed here, please visit the Vermont Law School Environmental Law Center page at www.vermontlaw.edu/ELC. This has been Rebecca Purdom for Vermont Law School's Hot Topics podcast. We hope you've enjoyed this program.